Lloyd John Ogilvy, who is a minister and counselor, tells of talking to a group of men at a breakfast one morning, and he decided he would talk to them about marriage and the home. And he decided he would begin with a series of questions that turned out to be a little bit more exciting than he had planned for them to be. He asked simply, "Do you love your wife more than you did when you were courting her? More than you did 10 years ago, 5 years ago, a week ago? If you have some very exciting news, who is the first person on earth you want to share that news with? Is it your companion? Will she greet it with the same enthusiasm you have? Do you look forward to going home at night? Whom do you look forward most to seeing? Your wife? Your children? Your dog? What intonation does your wife use when she announces to the children you're home? Is it an exclamation mark, "Daddy's home," or a semicolon, or perhaps a drab period? If you had an opportunity to spend an exciting, fun-filled weekend in New York City with one person, and you may choose anyone in the world, would you choose your wife? Do you still find her attractive and fascinating to be with? Or would you think seriously of choosing someone else? What is the one thing you could do today to communicate to her that you want to keep this marriage alive, that you want it to be filled with love and feeling? He said that after he got through with the meeting, he was amazed at the number of men who came and said, "My marriage hasn't been and isn't as exciting as I want it to be. And I think there are some suggestions here I need to act on, but I'm not sure which direction to go." So he and the men decided they would call that Just Because Day. It was Just Because Day, and they took home flowers or some gift with secret significance to the wife, and in other ways tried to renew the relationship. What the men didn't know was that he was later to speak to a group of ladies, many of them wives of the men he talked to that morning, and he decided, because of the effect of the first speech, he'd use the same thing but just change the sex, the pronouns, and all the questions. But he told the ladies what he'd already done in the breakfast meeting as he did it, and he said he couldn't help thinking that the question running through their minds while he was laying out the questions was, "What did my husband say about that one?" But the result, again, was somewhat satisfying. There were women who had their hair done that day. One woman said she called a travel agency and began making initial plans for a trip she'd been putting off making with her husband. There were all sorts of special things done, because one thing might be done to communicate in a special way that you want this relationship to stay alive. When you think about it, why would anyone get married nowadays? Everybody knows the strains marriage faces in America or in the world at large. With people as different as they are, or as we are, why would anyone undertake something that is going to take such tremendous energies to give it even a chance of success? Is it that she wants to prove that she is successful, and the symbol of her success is that she has been irresistibly attractive to at least one man? Is it that she wants the security of being able to leave the competitive workaday world and know exactly who's going to take care of her from now on? Is it that he wants to be sure he has an inexpensive housekeeper, chef, mistress, laundress, everything he needs in the home? Why do we get married? In Matthew 19th chapter, a group of opponents came to Jesus with questions. They raised the question, basically, is marriage supposed to be permanent? Does it have to be? And Jesus referred them back to the paragraph in Genesis 2, which you've heard read. "Haven't you read that he which made them in the beginning made them male and female?" And he went on to quote much of the passage. And Jesus came to the conclusion marriage is permanent. The only thing that is to dissolve it, short of death, is the unfaithfulness of one of the partners. After the group had gone, the disciples of Jesus turned to him with a comment, and it's a strange one, Matthew 19, verse 10. They said, "Lord, if it is the case of a man to be thus with his wife, it's not expedient for a man to marry." It's a bit hard to interpret what was going through the disciples' minds when they raised this suggestion, but it seems they were saying, if that's the way marriage is, if it's supposed to be permanent, if it's that kind of deep relationship, then it would just be better not to undertake something so serious as marriage. There is another way to look at it, and that is to view marriage as a permanent institution and try to make the contributions to it that God intended for us to make. What Genesis does is to describe marriage as a partnership of love. All of us have a big stake in this. Many of us are married. Others of us plan to be. And the kind of intimacy that the marriage relationship is supposed to afford through its partnership is just of supreme importance to any of us, to all of us. That, in a general way, sets out what the Bible's ideal for marriage is, a partnership of love. But I'd like to be specific, and with a half dozen suggestions, try to outline some of the things that would contribute to the proper answering of the questions I raised earlier. One of the specifics is that marriage is intended to be a partnership of ideals and goals. When God brought the woman to Adam, he'd already looked over all the animal creation. There was no partner there. But he looked at her and said, she will be bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. She'll be called woman. She was taken out of man. He could see an immediate sharing of ideals and goals with her. If a marriage is going to succeed, both partners need to know something of what their own intentions are. What are my goals in life? Where am I going basically with life? And where is my partner going with life? What are the things we can share in this relationship at the deepest of possible levels? If we're going in different directions, we're going to wind up 3 to 5 years down the road or 10 and notice that we're just going at cross purposes with each other. Young people who enter marriage nowadays have often had courses in premarital counseling. They've read books. They sometimes have talked to too many psychologists or read too many ideas from them. Our expectations for marriage may be quite unrealistic, but there's at least a determination, it seems, to prepare for marriage, to come to a sharing of ideals, and that's important. To be sure that basic goals are moving in the same direction. That gives a strong foundation. For a person just to think, I'm going to find a pearl, somewhat like you'd win something in a lottery, I'll find just the right man, just the right woman, is a very wrong approach to marriage. Marriage is approached with a partnership of ideals. We don't have a lot of time for dreaming nowadays. We're so glued to the television set, or we're so busy in all the activities we have to carry out. There really isn't time for a walk, just a slow walk. There isn't time to let poets take us out of the world of sight and sound. There isn't a whole lot of time for meditation of any kind or sharing of plans without interruption. But somewhere in the formation of the right kind of partnership, there has to be a marriage of ideals. That's one of the things pictured in the book of Genesis. A second thing is a partnership that involves spiritual implications, a partnership of faith. With the problems marriage faces nowadays, we never shall be able to have enough marriage counseling to take care of them. It will never be possible to have enough psychological texts to handle our problems. Our problems are deeper. We need another kind of counselor. We need a moral and spiritual counselor. We need someone to give us spiritual goals for marriage. And that undergirds everything in the relationship described in Genesis. When Paul was dealing with the question in Ephesians 5, he started his long paragraph on marriage with verse 21. Be subject to one another out of reverence for God. We've often dealt with the rest of the passage. The wife obeys the husband loves the wife, but it all starts with a mutual subjection out of reverence for God. That's the pyramid or triangular view of marriage. Husband here, wife here, God here. Spiritual ideals give marriage the greatest possible foundation. They add coherence to life. They give a cohesiveness because we haven't anything that strikes us at a deeper place than our spiritual commitments. If these are shared, marriage has a much better chance. Even that is too general. What we're really talking about is a commitment to Christ that's carried through in faith and obedience. Not just an admiration of Christ, but the marriage which really has the greatest chance of succeeding is the marriage where both partners are committed in faith to obedience to the Lord. If that deepest of all commitments is shared, then there's something great to build a relationship upon. Every family faces crises. There's an accident, illness, maybe terminal illness. And people who thought that faith was entirely dormant, the religious interest perhaps dead, find themselves almost in an involuntary fashion turning to God and asking help. That may not be saving faith, but it's a start. And to realize the need for that kind of faith in the marriage would be an even better start. A partnership of love ought to be a partnership of spiritual interests. A third thing in this passage is that it is a physical partnership. We don't need to play down the physical relationship because it's very present in the biblical treatment of marriage. The two of them shall become one flesh, God said. It's true that the physical relationship is much overplayed in our society, that we have a barrage of books and movies which indicate that this is the only thing of real importance in life, that marriage manuals are being proliferated in an incredible fashion today, numerically, and that a good many of them advise, as George and Nina O'Neill do in their book, Open Marriage, that the marriage relationship ought to be open to more partners than just the marriage partner. They want to get out of the narrowness of the traditional Christian view of monogamy. Almost every, if not every, seriously disturbed marriage has its physical dimension. And often when the couple goes for counseling, they may think it's the primary dimension. But the most astute counselors say that it is almost never, perhaps never, the primary problem, though it is likely always a problem. Their reason for that is that the physical relationship of marriage grows out of all the other relationships. That if something is awry here, it's an indication that something deeper is awry. Everybody knows something of what it means to have a friend come and put an arm around you when you're in a moment of depression or discouragement. There's something about touch that nothing else can communicate. You know the virtue of taking a little baby in your arms, because a baby's personality is in part formed by the way he's coddled in infancy. We all know those special implications of touch, and these go into the physical relationship of marriage. Paul in 1 Corinthians 7 said, the wife doesn't have power over her own body but the husband, nor does the husband have power over his own body but the wife. But he leaves us with the conclusion that the physical relationship is mutually willed, that it is the fruition of all other relationships of marriage. A partnership which is physical. A partnership of ideals, a partnership of spiritual goals, a physical partnership. The partnership also involves very mundane things like finances. Most of us enter marriage without a very good conception of how finances are to be managed because somebody else has managed them at the serious points. And again, many couples who go for counseling go with extreme problems at the area of the management of those finances. And yet, counselors say that ordinarily, the problem is not insufficient finances. The problem is immaturity in handling the finances. The husband has a number of hobbies, selfish interests, and he spends too much on those interests and blames the wife because not enough things are being provided in the household with what is left. The wife has interests And she drives the husband to succeed and then complains because he buries himself in his work and doesn't have any time for her. Money never means the same to both partners. It may be status and security to one. It may be freedom to spend and have a good time to the other. But somehow there has to be mutual planning. Someone needs to be given the ultimate responsibility for management. That can be either partner. But it has to be by mutual agreement. The books have to be open. There has to be mutual decision making. And while finances are not mentioned in the text itself, the agreement here is crucial to the things that are outlined there. Charlie Shedd, who's an author, counselor, suggests a basis upon which young people might start their budgetary planning for life. He says, give 10%. Save 10%. Live the rest. Well, that's one basis, but there has to be a basis. And what he has tried to do is draw in several implications of common needs and out of that form a basis on which the rest of the financial planning will be done. But if we naively suspect that at the end of the month, the incoming bills and the outgoing paycheck will always balance, the marriage will likely face a crisis at the financial point. And then there are family relationships involved in this partnership of love. For this cause shall a man leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two shall be one. Problems come from both directions here. There are instances where the father and mother of the bride or groom will simply not allow enough room in which this marriage is able to begin and form its own existence. In reality, a new person comes into being in this wedding. But because not enough room is allowed, strains and pressures begin to be felt. And from the other side, there's often an unawareness on the part of one of the marriage partners or both that the partner is marrying not just a person, but a family. A person with very deep roots, very close relationships, and it isn't right to expect that person to pull up all those relationships just because a new one has been formed. There has to be room for the marriage and yet not a destruction of other relationships. Leave father and mother, but not destroy the relationship with father and mother. Somewhere a balance has to be found. And family relationships respected, and yet the new relationship become primary. In our world, the problems are very complex at that point. They may have something to do with longevity, the aging process, and the fact that sometimes we have three or four generations in the same household. They may have something to do with illness or even terminal illness. That means that one person must be cared for a long time because of his or her being a relative of the marriage partner. And those of us who haven't faced such experiences are probably not very wise to give detailed advice about how to handle them. And yet, family relationships are there. They're to be respected. But the Bible insists on the primacy of the new relationship, the husband-wife relationship. The partnership of ideals, of spiritual goals, physical sharing, financial and family sharing, is culminated in a partnership of communication. This one may seem the least tangible of all, but it may be the key to handling all the rest. In an awful lot of cases today where marriages are in difficulty, the claim by one partner is, I'm being used, I'm being manipulated, I'm not being respected. It comes through so many ways, in literature, in life. In Henrik Ibsen's A Doll House, you may remember that the leading woman character complains that she had always just been her papa's doll. She'd never really been a person. She was just his to play with, to be entertained by. Now she has married her husband and been absorbed by his ideals, and she's really just been his doll. She's still not a person. And unfortunately, she's made her own children into her dolls, like the dolls she had back when she was growing up under Papa. And she finally rebels against it all because she hasn't had an opportunity to be a person. She's felt that she was being used and manipulated. Paul Turnier, in his To Understand Each Other, says that a good bit of our conversations in marriage are like dialogues of the deaf. Two people are talking, but each one is only setting forth his or her own case. We're insisting on being understood, on getting our own way across. We're just waiting while the other person talks so we can make our next point and either accuse that person or justify ourselves. One of Francis of Assisi's prayers was, "Lord, grant that I may seek not so much to be understood as to understand." The determination to understand the other person is basic to everything we've talked about. God saw that it was not good for the man to be alone. In our impersonal society, that's even more important. A person who insists on being alone, on keeping everything on the inside, is inviting illness. We need somebody to share with, to share the deepest concerns of life with. But for some reason, we've either lost or we've never had the power to communicate, to share the deepest joys and sorrows of life. Either we haven't gotten the ability to understand the other person, or we haven't gotten the ability or the willingness to communicate ourselves, and both are necessary. We don't want to unfold our deepest being because that makes us vulnerable. The other person knows too much about us, and we might be judged or criticized. John Powell has a little paperback that's enjoying presently some of the popularity that I'm Okay, You're Okay enjoyed 2 or 3 years ago. And it's called Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? Accompanied by a number of illustrations and graffiti. Powell's book is built on a conversation from a person who came with problems. And the conversation simply said, "I'm afraid to tell you who I am because if I tell you who I am, you may not like who I am, and it's all I've got." And that does strike a chord with an awful lot of people. If I really tell you who I am, you may not like it. And that's all I have. So I'm not really going to tell you. I'm going to wear this mask for the rest of my life. You'll never really know the innermost desires of my being. I won't bear them to you. And a marriage which keeps that kind of barrier up isn't going to be what it ought to be. We weren't made to be alone. We were made to share. But it's so hard to communicate. We almost insist on being alone, even within this most intimate of relationships. Albert Mehrabian is a communications expert. After a decade of study in how do we fail, why can't we communicate with each other, he wrote an article in Psychology Today a few years back, in which he suggested the proportions that of our communication that come through words and through other forms. Based on a dialogue such as one might have in marriage between two people, Arabian says 7% of our communication happens through words alone, 38% through the intonation or the inflection of those words, and the other 55% through posture and facial expressions and gestures. And so he argues a husband may tell his wife or wife or husband, "I love you," but you can do it in 100 different ways and communicate 100 different conclusions every time. It can be said bitterly as if an answer to a demand, or it can be said quite differently. But only 7% of the content is gotten across through the words alone. A partnership of communication. What do you think about when you think of the word marriage? Don't you think of brides, candles, white lace, honeymoons, silver, crystal? What do you think about when you think of the word family? Yard work,
dishes, responsibilities, children. Somehow we haven't brought the two together. Our ideals, our world of fancy, and the world of reality into which all of this must fit. But we all have a stake in it, a big stake. We're in a very impersonal world, but we're persons, and we're made for partnership. The beginning place for that partnership is a partnership of faith. Faith and obedience to Jesus Christ, with his teachings, with them applied to the various facets of life, the kind of partnership of love God envisioned at the beginning can become a reality. But it will never succeed without that spiritual base. That's what we hope you'll build if you don't have it, while we sing.
Love.